And now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lernis.
Hi, everyone. This is Dean Haglund here in the offices of Rational Exuberance in the heart of the historic core in the middle of the Art Deco wonder that it is the Eastern Columbia. This is your Chilpack Hollywood Hour, and we are here, as always, with your co-host, Mr. Nuffity Nuff, kind of a big deal, Mr. Phil Lernis.
Are you TV's Dean Haglund?
I may be.
Boy, do I have a lot to talk about.
I know.
With you.
What? Another production meeting on air?
Welcome to your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Hooray.
Whether you are listening to us on Jackalope Radio.
It's Friday at 7, if it is.
Talk Superstation.
But whenever we're on there.
Yeah. And
I don't know the times.
Or if you come straight to ChilpackHollywood.com.
Maybe you're an iTunes subscriber.
Which you might have done through ChilpackHollywood.com or an RSS subscriber. Or maybe you just download them and stream them. Maybe you listen on Facebook now. Maybe you listen on MySpace. Some people do.
Absolutely.
Don't kid yourself.
Maybe you're just hiding somewhere in this office.
Maybe you are here with us today.
Today. We don't even know.
In which case, we say welcome. And, you know.
Good job.
Dean Haglund, when I am on other shows.
What? You do other shows?
We both do interviews.
Oh, yes, that's right.
And sometimes the question comes up.
Yes.
To describe Chilpack Hollywood Hour, which you would think would be easy because we've been doing it now for more than 5 years.
Yeah, but it's not easy.
Because there's no shortage of things that we talk about.
Right.
And one of, and we used to have jokes that we would use to describe it, like we talk about school closings and I don't know, celebrity deaths, but those aren't really jokes.
And, we actually do talk about them.
So one of the things that I say, at least in conversation, it comes out easier in conversation, and that's what this is, after
right.
all, as opposed to being put on the spot by an interview, is that I think we are both very active and engaged people with myriad interests. We share many interests. We have several unique interests. And on this show, if I were to describe it as I do to people in conversation, it's generally that really we talk about anything that's going on in the world that has captured our interest, our attention, our fancy, our delight, our disgust, whatever. And we tend to tailor our conversations through the prism of how that issue, event, person, what have you, is being depicted in the media in its many forms, be it news or movies or television. We tend to come at it
that way.
That way.
Only because that's the way we experience it. So
right. And that's what we tend to know.
And we know media.
That's how we tend to want to express our interest in those things. So that and I was really thinking about that because everything that has been going on in the last week, these stories that all of which were troubling in some way, and then when the media got a hold of them, oh my God, it just compounds the troubling feelings upon troubling feelings.
It's true.
It seems no matter how the media depicts things these days, it just pulls us further down a rabbit hole.
I know, without, and you could see them trying to be sensitive, but the very nature of the way the news is issued is desensitizing.
On Combat Radio on Friday, I was fortunate enough to be invited to be a part of it again on Friday.
Right.
The guest was the journalist, used to write for Variety, writes for the New York Times now, is a regular columnist for the Daily Beast, Nicole Laporte, who wrote the really fantastic book, The Men Who Would Be King, about the making and unmaking of DreamWorks. And she's really refreshing in journalism, period, let alone in entertainment journalism, the entertainment industry, because she really is this combination of being, and this is such a word I tend to
say all the
try
time.
To disavow,
oh,
no,
really.
Which is she really does tend to be fair in her approach, while at the same time acknowledging that there are such a thing as facts.
Right.
And, you know, we do have this era in which we live where there seems to be so much bias And not only does there seem to be so much bias, depending on where you're getting your news and information, but then there's so much biased talk about the bias. And as a result, I think you see in a lot of sources, a lot of news and information sources now, there is almost this bending over backwards towards fairness. In fact, that's what Aaron Sorkin on one of the episodes of The Newsroom talked about. He says what nobody does talk about is the fairness bias. There's the liberal elite bias. There's right. the right-wing bias. Nobody talks about what's going on in a lot of places, which is the fairness bias, where, and the example he used was if the Republican caucus, let's say, went into Congress and said the earth, they declared a resolution that the earth is flat.
Right.
Many news outlets would report the story not as the Republican caucus has lost its mind.
Right.
They would report it as there is disagreement between Democrats and Republicans over shape of earth.
Right.
Ignoring that there are facts.
Right.
And so this is a woman who does have facts, does report facts. And I guess if I were to describe what fairness is, it would be that... You remember when we had the conversation once about criticism and critics and the importance of the people who are receiving criticism not to take things personally.
Right.
And the responsibility of the people offering the criticism not to make it personal.
Yeah.
And she does a remarkable job of this. And in particular, one column on the Daily Beast that I remember she wrote that I read back in 2010 was about Mel Gibson when those tapes came out, separation from
the girlfriend.
And she really laid out the facts and said, you know, what we are talking about here is a cycle of abuse, a pattern of abuse. And she did a wonderful job of laying this out
right.
without going into rhetoric about even Mel Gibson being a horrible person or any of these sort of things.
Right.
It was about, no, he's an abusive personality.
Because
and this is
the
it.
Things.
And
yeah, right.
she also seemed to recognize in this article that, again, as we learn in the violence prevention movement, violence is learned, it's reinforced, it's encouraged, and it requires learning new choices.
Right.
And so it was very interesting to be on a show with this woman, you know, at the end of a week where there were so many stories that the conversation about them in the media never seemed in any way to frame the conversation in a way that would help us find our way.
Right. Yes. In fact, it made it very frustrating. I don't know. Was it a fairness bias?
I don't know. I mean, we'll get into some of these things. And you know what was interesting? I was watching several videos from Alex Jones, especially in the wake of the Aurora, Colorado massacre. But I found one that was really interesting, and I think you can find it on YouTube under the name Alex Jones versus Jon Stewart versus President Obama.
Really?
And it was really interesting because it goes back to the end of the year and President Obama signing the authorization for the detainment of American citizens.
Yes.
And Alex, of course, stumped as a town crier about these things.
Mm-hmm.
And he took to task, Jon Stewart really took him to task. I mean, in his video, he showed clips from The Daily Show and really, really attacked Jon Stewart for making light of these things and took the standpoint that there's nothing funny about this, Stewart, and you're part of the problem, you're not part of the solution. And what was stunning to me about it was I watched the Jon Stewart clip.
Yeah.
And what Jon Stewart was making fun of from the outset, what he was satirizing, was the instinct to dismiss anyone who can be categorized as a conspiracy theorist.
Ah.
Because he starts out making fun of the, you know, President Obama's a Muslim, he's a socialist, he's trying to take away your rights, he's doing, you know, and he's making fun of the conspiracy theorist.
Right.
And then they play the clip of him President Obama authorizing the detainment, and then you see Stewart go, what?
Right.
You know, so what he was making fun of was this idea of eliminating someone's point of view because you can categorize them as crazy or extremist or any of these sort of things.
Right.
And then you see the behavior on the part of these people and, well, wait, we should all be paying attention.
Right. And so, and that's the whole thing about being a conspiracy theorist is when the facts actually come out and you can only say, I told you so, at the end of it.
Well, and so it was so frustrating for me because here are two people that you and I like, mm-hmm. Alex Jones and Jon Stewart, and they agreed. And they were going after the same target in totally different tones.
Right.
And here was Alex. Now, I don't think Jon Stewart ever issued any kind of response. I don't think Alex has ever been featured on The Daily Show, which is very significant because, again, The Daily Show's target is less political leaders as it is the media that's failing to hold political leaders accountable.
Totally. They're more, when their media culture critiques, I think, are more dead on than their political jokes.
You know, and that's the thing. When people will try to say to him, you know, you're the most trusted figure in news, he's the first to expose that as, well, that's horrible. You people are the news people.
Right.
I'm the comedian.
I'm a fake
I'm making
news thing.
Fun of you not doing your job.
Right.
And so it frustrated me and it saddened me, really, that, you know, Alex and Jon Stewart were both making the same point and both reaching different people who will respond to different tones, and yet somehow now it's you know, it's Alex Jones versus Jon Stewart.
Right.
And in a way that does let, in this case, President Obama off the hook little bit, because people are going to get wrapped up in Jon Stewart versus Alex Jones. And indeed, you read the comments on it. There's people bashing Alex Jones for bashing Jon Stewart. There's people defending Jon Stewart. There's people defending Alex Jones. Meanwhile, none of these comments are about Obama signing into law authorizing the detainment of U.S. citizens.
Not just the detainment. They could send drones to Yemen and take out American citizens.
Well, there's all of these. This was just what this one video was about, and it's emblematic. And so, again, you know, what saddens me, it really does sadden me, is how many of us have things upon which we could agree, and we have the ability to start asking better questions and holding our quote-unquote leaders and the people in power accountable.
Right.
But we get distracted from those things by fighting with each other.
Yes.
And so that...
And some would say that's part of the conspiracy, is that you turn the two on each other. And,
well, some would say you've been one of the people that really has said that. And it's becoming more and more true.
Right.
And, you know, I will talk about this on this show too, but, you know, I was thinking one of the reasons that America leads the world in conspiracy theories, and that this kind of conspiratorial thought, as we know, when we were traveling to Europe, shooting The Truth Is Out There, it was only starting to come to certain parts of Europe.
Yeah.
And they were asking us about it because we have this long history of conspiracy theories and conspiracy theories being a part of the fabric of our culture. And one of the reasons I believe, just one, I'm not throwing it all under this, but I really, in looking at this past week, one of the reasons we lead the world in this is because we are a nation of laws, a nation based in large part on a legal system.
Right.
And an important part of that legal system is this idea of proving motive.
Right.
Right? And so conspiracy theories involve a proving of motive.
Right.
A lot of time. This is who they are. This is why they're doing this, this, and this, and this.
Right. You line up a series of facts, and then you go and you attach a motive to it by
a
group.
As you know, I get really, again, frustrated and saddened that we are this country of lawyers, that it has seeped into our relationships, right? People are constantly trying to prove, well, this was your fault, and this is why you did it.
Yeah,
and this
putting you on trial.
Instead of could just get to that point of saying, especially in our relationships, hey, I want you to know that thing I did didn't serve you, me, us, the situation. I want you to know I understand that. And then the other person being able to say, cool, well, I don't want you to feel bad about it. I appreciate you telling me that.
Right.
Boom. Move on to a next moment, right?
Right.
But we do get so wrapped up in that because we're We're a nation of laws. We're a nation of proving motive. Can you prove means, motive, opportunity? And motive for me is just crap in a judicial system, in a system of justice. Because you know what? Just prove that the person committed a crime. Right. I don't care why they did it. If you're trying to prove someone committed a crime, prove it. Prove that they committed the crime. Now, if you're defending them, then yeah, you might want to bring in, okay, yeah, they did it, but they had a good reason.
Right, exactly.
Like something like that.
Right.
That's when it comes into play. But I want you to prove to me that they did it. And that's how I feel a lot with, you know, conspiracy theories, as we've talked about with 9/11 and so many other things. Or this case with Obama, with the detaining of U.S. citizens. I don't need you to try to link him with Muslim groups. I don't need you to try to link him with the Trilateral Commission. I don't need you to try to link him with George Soros. I don't need any of these things because you know what? What he's doing is wrong.
Right. Already the facts are there.
So, to a degree, it's great that you have this theory and pursuing this. At the same time, though, recognize again, what is your aim? Is your aim to prove a theory, or is your aim to get people to wake up about what is actually going on that's affecting them that we should be trying to stop right now?
Yeah.
And measure those things. And that's a tough road to navigate.
Because often,
and you'll never always get it right.
Right. And you think that the discussion of that facts is when you get bogged down in motive, then you take yourself farther away from, you know, here's the fact. Here's something signed into law. It's wrong. And now what should we do about that? As opposed to, oh, you know why they did it.
Right.
And then arguing that point becomes a bit of waste of energy.
And like you said, it's part of the conspiracy, I think, in that it can be allowed then to
derail,
disengage people from each other who could very easily find common ground.
Right.
The and 99, if we can call them that, right?
Exactly.
But how do we disengage them from, well, we prove what that group's motives are
right.
in going after this. And this group has a different motive, and this group has a different motive. So suddenly at the end of it, it doesn't matter that they all agreed on the facts.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
They have different motives, we'll never be able to do business with those people.
I know. It's like high school where they go, you know what Sally said about you? Oh, my God. And then, you know why she said it? And you try break up a clique.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of thing.
So this is a great introduction because the first thing I wanted to ask you about was actually Daniel Tosh.
Oh, yes.
This is the host of
Tosh 2.0.
The kids' generation, the young generation's Tom Bergeron.
I didn't realize.
Really?
Yeah,
he's nothing more than that because, quite frankly, you know, you can't call him a stand-up comedian.
Not anymore. Well, I didn't then either, really.
Yeah, but exactly. He's Tom Bergeron without the class.
the gravitas.
So do you want to recap for anyone who doesn't know what took place during his stand-up performance?
I never even saw the performance. Like, I didn't get the transcripts. But basically, he did a rape joke on stage as a heckle put-down. And
well, he was doing it. Audience members took umbrage to it, particularly a woman who did not think rape jokes are funny, and his response was, wouldn't it be funny if after this show that woman got gang raped?
Right.
Pointing at the woman who was heckling.
Right. And
this has caused some controversy.
Some controversy. You know, there's pressure when you're on stage, of course, and you're apt to say things off the top of your head that you regret later. I'm trying to think of an example if I did that.
Michael Richards is a great example.
But as somebody pointed out, you know, Michael Richards came from hate. His was thing, and Tosh was actually trying to be funny. So Michael Richards kind of lost it in anger, whereas Tosh was like trying to make some sort of ironic hilarity, similar to how he makes ironic hilarity off the videos on Tosh 2.0.
The appeal of Tosh 2.0 is not Tosh, it is the videos.
Yeah.
That's why the Tom Bergeron reference.
It saves you so much time going through the internet watching that show. But, you know, I've seen other comics who've been really inappropriate, and I've seen comics get rewarded for that inappropriateness. Doug Stanhope in his Edinburgh show had a whole 15 minutes on rape that a lot of people found really offensive and other people thought was completely brilliant. And, you know, a lot of stand-ups go into these issues that are taboo in the society because they have the platform to do it. And that is the tradition of stand-ups. This is going back to Lenny Bruce, right? And
can we ever say that there is something out of bounds for comedy? Can we say that? I mean, you know, this Alex Jones really criticizing Jon Stewart because this is not funny. This is not funny. You know, Stewart, and he kept calling him Stewart. Stewart, this isn't funny. You know, is there anything that is out of bounds?
You know, this is the horrible thing. If you say yes, then you're accused of censorship and stifling the creative energy
Let
of a
me,
comic.
I'm going to come back to you on is there anything, because this, you know, is one of my big bugaboos.
Yes, it is.
We have freedom of speech in this country.
Right.
And it is our first, in our First Amendment, it is part of our First Amendment. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances.
Right.
It is in that First Amendment several rights contained therein.
Right.
The purpose, of course, when you read the letters of the Founding Fathers in debating and in drafting the Bill of Rights was to protect political speech. Of course, one of the people who was a big advocate of this Bill of Rights was John Adams, who also, unfortunately, was president when the Alien and Sedition Act was signed, which, of course, made it illegal to criticize the president.
Right.
So go figure. But really, they were... think of the times. Think of the... They were not setting out to protect entertainers.
Right.
They were setting out to protect political speech. And, indeed, the comedians of the time, who were the cartoonists. They were setting out to protect them as well.
Yeah.
But... So always remember that the impetus behind freedom of speech was political speech. Now, I, of course, am a big one for this idea of... hopefully we all as individuals mature to the point where we can practice right speech. We will only get there through practicing speech.
Right.
Right. But there are limits to freedom of speech, and people need to remember this, that there are legal limits to it.
But there's hate crimes in Canada for that very thing, that this is right. The idea that you can't just go and say anything you want.
There's the Miller test for obscenity. There are child pornography laws. Mm-hmm. Speech that incites imminent lawless action, as you're describing. Regulation of commercial speech is allowed. Commercial speech being anything that involves
money?
Advertising.
Ah.
So, of course, if it's on a show that is sponsored by advertisers, it can be regulated.
Right.
It is commercial speech.
Right. That's why you beep stuff out.
And within these limited areas, there's other limitations on free speech, you know, that balance rights to other rights.
Right. But this goes over...
Rights for authors and inventors to own and control their own work, for example.
Right.
You can't go on stage and recite someone else's work and claim freedom of speech.
That's true. But comics do that.
that's true.
I'm leaning away from the Constitution on this one and towards creative artistic expression.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely. Well, but, and this is the thing, is I think everyone that tried to make this an issue of freedom of speech. There's freedom of speech, right?
Yeah.
That's almost to a degree to beside the point.
Absolutely.
Yes, there's freedom of speech. And I, as I've said, I think... There's no reason that legally he should not have said what he said.
Right.
On stage. However, freedom of speech does not mean you're entitled to freedom from repercussion.
That's right.
It does not mean you're free from the responsibility of owning up to what you said.
Absolutely. And so therein lies the thing, that the real punishment would have been that nobody laughed at that, that everybody found that distasteful, didn't laugh at it, and therefore he learns on his own thing that that kind of joke bombs and he doesn't do it again. There's not going to be any legal recourse. There should be something that every comic who has a goal to get better, and when they say something stupid and it doesn't get a laugh, doesn't say that again.
Well,
it's a self-correcting thing.
How about this? If I'm that woman, yeah. I'm contacting lawyers and going after that club.
Wow.
Yeah, suffering, pain and suffering.
Gee whiz.
Well, and if a lawsuit was leveled against a club,
wow,
there's a repercussion against Daniel Tosh.
Yeah.
How many clubs are not going to go near him then?
Well, but then how many clubs are then going to go, tell me your act? And at this point, well, then I'm in trouble because I improvise a whole lot of show. And
is that wrong? But so then, is that wrong? Because, look, you are not going to... You do improv comedy.
Right.
You do not script anything.
Right.
You have had incredible things go wrong. You have had someone bite you. Never yeah. mind jokes bomb. You have had someone bite you. You've had people heckle you. You've had these things happen.
Yeah.
And you...
I don't think I've...
Have never advocated...
Legal
or
recourse.
Seemed to advocate someone getting gang raped.
That's true. I never
and
did that.
So, you know,
but
maybe,
he was already in a riff about rape. I think that was...
So it was on his mind.
It was on his mind.
I guess so what I'm asking you, though, is if something were like that yeah. were to happen, where it becomes then difficult for other performers because of what this guy did,
yeah.
do other performers... You know the comedy world. Obviously, they will go to his defense to defend a performer's right on stage, and also to say, you know, sometimes things go wrong.
Yeah.
And we are all human, and in the heat of moments, we will say things that we regret. We will say things, a lot of times, that we don't mean. You
yeah.
know why? Because we do that as human beings. Every day throughout the day.
Yeah.
You know, well, people ask how you are, and you say, doing great, even though you're not.
Right.
You say, nice to meet you to people,
yeah, right.
even though most of the time you don't mean
care.
It.
Yeah,
so we
right.
say things we don't mean all the time, especially to our friends and in relationships all
right.
the time. We say things we don't mean in the heat of moments. So this is part of the human experience, and I think comics would stand in defense of any other comic for these reasons, but would they... behind
well,
the scenes take a guy aside.
Yes, I've seen that happen. I've totally seen that happen. And I'll take you back to the 90s when Andrew Dice Clay was somehow a big deal. And he started, because he was being rewarded for being, you know, the raucous guy in the leather jacket, his material started getting more and more raunchy to the point where other comics didn't support him. And then there became that backlash, at which point he changed his whole image, and then Howard Stern was no longer supporting him, and that was the end of that. So this idea that all comics just take him aside, there were comics publicly dissing Andrew Dice Clay, and that diminished the offensiveness and the audience that he had to mm-hmm. the point where that he may still be very offensive in a comedy club somewhere. But A, nobody's hearing about it, and B, maybe nobody's going. So it's self-correcting
in a social
situation. So to have a legal recourse come down on it, I think is unnecessary unless, is anybody really offended? The idea is you're going to a comedy club, you know there's going to be heckles and put-downs. You don't know, you know. You can't guarantee what comic's going to cross a line. And here's the other thing. Even if that law was in place that the clubs had to say, hey, what's your material? Even if Tosh then laid out that material, the thing he said was not in his act. I mean, that was the thing. He said that after an afterthought because he was so angry or whatever his mindset was as a heckle put down that he crossed a line that I'm sure he's regretting right now.
Yes.
He's not going around going, I did it. That was an awesome set. He's like, the pressure on him now is probably overwhelming.
Yes. So to get back, is there any topic that isn't okay for humor?
Well, yeah, because people aren't going to laugh at it. So those are the topics you don't do.
The topic that an audience won't laugh at. But that seems to me then that what you're saying is there isn't any kind of universal topic that isn't funny. It's based on context. It's based on where you are, the audience.
And the timing.
And the timing.
Mean, gee whiz, there was this... And when I was doing Amateur Night in 1986 and the space shuttle exploded, that night some idiot comic came up and did a bit about it way too soon, didn't get a laugh, and he walked off in complete silence because everybody was super offended. And then all the other comics went, what were you thinking? And he never did that again. And he turned out to be a great comic afterwards.
One of the great things about comedy, and you talk about this in Truth Is Out There with Lee McCloskey, with Marilyn Schlitz at Institute of Noetic Sciences, with others, the ability that comedy gives you to look at things from different perspectives by turning things on their side. And if you truly are creating a new perspective on something through comedy, then how could it not be valid?
Right.
How could it not maybe even have value?
Well, you know, exactly.
The difference between valid and value.
Value.
So to say that there are things that are not okay for comedy is both, it's Schrodinger's cat, if I've learned from you correctly, because it's both true and not true.
At the same
time. It's true in, like you said, the context of where you are right then with that audience, such and such a thing might never be okay for comedy.
Right.
So it's true, but it's not true in that there is the possibility of another audience at the same time, you know, where that is something funny. It also, though, is interesting because the topic itself of something not ever being funny can be rife with humor.
Right.
You know, possibilities for humor.
Yeah.
So if you get people laughing at the notion that there are things that are never funny, well, then aren't things by definition always possibly funny?
That then comes down to the skill of the comic.
And skill of the comic.
And that's Louis C.K.'s specialty, because he'll take the most mundane things and make them very funny.
I like what you said about it being self-correcting. I mean, that's always been the way with comedy.
Absolutely.
It's always been self-correcting.
And you're not going to have anybody go up there for an hour and not get a laugh and get booked again. No matter what they're saying is true, you know, it just doesn't happen. There'll be like, you know, even Bill Hicks, who was hilarious, had a lot of clubs not book him because a lot of people came, hey, I don't come to a comedy club to think. And he'd say, well, where do you go to think? I'll meet you there and do my act. Seriously.
Fred Willard.
Speaking of great comics.
Speaking of bad choices of words, on Combat Radio on Friday, they gave me a few minutes to preview what was coming up on... and I appreciate this. Ethan Dettenmeyer, the host of Combat Radio, is such a gracious host. And he gives a few minutes at the top and at the end to really just plug whatever you got to plug, you know. Yeah. But and so I used the opportunity to preview what we would talk about on this show. And I said, and we'll probably touch on Fred Willard. And then realized that's probably just the worst turn of phrase in a lifetime of bad turns of phrase for me.
Fred Willard.
So Fred Willard, the brilliant comedic actor, beloved. I mean, really improviser. An institution, as he might be institutionalized. you know, so wonderful in the Christopher Guest films.
Yes, Martin Mull and Fernwood Tonight.
Fernwood Tonight is so great. He's a multiple Emmy winner. As well, Fred Willard, for his sitcom guest appearances over the last decade.
Mm-hmm.
He was arrested for lewd behavior in an adult movie theater in Hollywood during a routine vice sweep of the adult theater.
Right, which is shocking that there's even porn theaters left. I didn't know they still operated these things. I mean, who's paying money to go? I mean, I'm shocked. That shocked me. Yeah. I actually looked it up on like where they can't be a theater.
So you're shocked that there are still these theaters. Yeah. I'm shocked. I love the when you say that, I think of Claude Rains always in Casablanca. I'm shocked to find there's gambling going on in there. I am shocked to find that there's lewd behavior going on in an adult theater. Yeah. Why would you have the theater?
Right.
If not to have a place where people can come together for lewd behavior.
Well, yeah, because who just appreciates the art form?
And what is lewd behavior? How are we going to define this? I mean, doesn't this have to be context?
Doesn't it have to be context? Yeah.
What is lewd on a public bus
yes.
or in front of a schoolyard is got to be different than maybe in your own bedroom or in
right.
your, you know, in your adult movie theater.
Well, but this is a public place. This is a public-private issue, I think.
Okay.
And so
if I am on a train or a plane and I am watching a porn film on my laptop.
Yes. In a private compartment, first class.
I'm saying on a train or in a plane, in a cabin,
yeah.
if I'm watching a porn film on there, I can get in trouble for doing that
yes.
in public.
It's public.
But so too, you're saying is an adult movie theater public, but I'm not getting in trouble for watching porn.
That's...
I'm just getting in trouble for being turned on by it.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, this becomes the tricky thing because then lewd behavior has to be the same law everywhere. You can't go, this is a lewd behavior free zone that you put outside the door.
But you can because... remember, the bathhouses in San Francisco were shut down as a public health issue, not a lewd issue. If there's private membership, if there's clubs, if there's this, you know, I don't...
So does a theater ticket to the porn house make it a private members club only?
It isn't. No, it isn't. But I'm saying we're talking about such legal distinctions at
yeah.
this point, and I get back to this idea of I'm shocked that in an adult-only... theater, there is lewd behavior
yeah.
going on. I'm shocked.
I am. Well, I'm shocked that that's what our police resources
and
are
that our resources are going to
what
that.
What the hell is that?
Yeah, we couldn't have used cops occasionally patrolling movie theaters in Colorado, could we?
Right. Or how about there's a dead body was just found 3 blocks from here on Spring Street, and now there's helicopters in the air. Nobody saw how the body happened. Why aren't we,
I just,
go over this again.
I don't, you know, if...
At the same time, I have to agree with Albert Brooks, get a den in a laptop. I mean, really?
Well, no, exactly, except I, there are stories about Fred Willard of over the past couple years. He's at a certain age
right.
now. He has been around a long time, and there are certain stories, and I feel for Fred Willard and his family. I would not be entirely surprised if Fred Willard, to a degree, didn't even know where he was.
Oh.
And you know, you do have to sometimes take into account
the age.
Age and things like this, and this will all play out. It will be self-correcting, as you say. I just can't, you know, that this is even news. Why does this man, after this life, have to get run through the media gauntlet for something like this,
which,
by the way, I mean, is this not victimless? I mean, God, I hope it is. I mean, I don't
yeah.
know. I can only imagine, if there is a victim in this, what that story is about.
But the janitor, maybe.
But just the lewd behavior... and it just, you know, again, our relationship in this country to sex versus violence is just so disturbing to me. And was it Lenny Bruce? I'm going to bastardize this quote, but was it Lenny Bruce who said something along the lines that the only lewd thing you can actually do to the human body is to maim it or kill it?
Right.
And
that's pretty much his.
I get disappointed whenever I hear, you know, stories about...
Yeah, and I think everyone's in the same boat, and I don't think it's getting a lot of traction. I mean, when you compare this to the Pee Wee Herman thing of 10, 15 years ago...
Right.
And how long that stayed in the news cycle, and how, you know, there was tons of news stories. You're not hearing it here. I think we have grown slightly, even if the... police mythology has not grown in 15 years. sociological attitudes have changed.
Yeah, and
enough.
I mean, like you said, though, the we're spending money on this. Yeah. We're spending money on these vice sweeps of these adult theaters.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't even know we even had a vice department anymore. Like, gambling's legal. What's left in vice? I can't even think of it.
I don't know.
Yeah.
So...
Other than porn theaters.
Aurora, Colorado, Dark Knight Rises, midnight screening. At this point, what we know, James Holmes is in custody, was arraigned today, the suspect, mm-hmm. with orange hair now. Somebody's given him hair dye in prison. And
no, he had it before. He dyed
oh, he did?
It. Yeah, he dyed it to go
okay.
to the movie.
12 dead at this point, 58 injured.
Right.
And within hours after the... incident. Alex Jones had a video that said that all evidence pointed to this being a staged terrorist attack to help President Obama go to the UN and bring in this international ban on weapons.
Which I haven't heard that one.
And Clyde Lewis, our friend Clyde Lewis at mm-hmm. Ground Zero, had an piece that he wrote tying in the massacre with the mural at the Denver airport.
Oh, my.
There are all of these theories, and they came very, very quickly on the heels of it. And, of course, we immediately saw many people breaking into camps about, this is... Can't we finally have gun control? And
right.
guns don't kill people.
Crazy people do.
Crazy people do, or people on pharmacological medications kill people.
Right.
And all these things, a debate over gun control and everybody finding their own.
Well, and buying all this weapons and ammunition online. I didn't know I could do that.
Well, I am... Maybe we'll spend a few moments here talking about guns and gun control and our thoughts on it. It's such a prickly topic.
Yeah.
I do think it's odd that a 24-year-old can legally buy all these guns, but he can't rent a car.
That seems odd.
You know, you have to be 25 to rent a car.
Right.
Because you have to have a certain level of maturity and responsibility before they'll insure you.
You'll break the car.
Yeah.
But with the guns.
But the guns.
You're not going to break them.
No, there's a safety on them.
There's a safety. They're completely safe.
So these things are such arbitrary age limits.
Restrictions, yeah.
And I just don't understand, what are we considering mature? And that, getting back to the Fred Willard thing for just a moment, this euphemism of adult theater.
Right.
Can we please establish what we mean by adult? Because to me, that kind of behavior, though, this is what I expect people are doing in those kind of theaters. And I have nothing but really, I've got to be honest with you, compassion for a man in his, 70s?
77.
Who's sitting alone in that theater doing that. I have a lot of kind of sorrow and compassion for him. I would not, however, define that theater as an adult theater. I'm not sure that what I define as adulthood involves exploitation and or the behavior on the part of the audience enjoying this exploitation.
Right. And, well, yes. And is it adult for police to go in there, raid? Like, you know who you're going to find in there. People, old, yeah, well, I give up.
I guess the two big issues that maybe we ought to take a few moments to address are this debate that's going to happen again about gun control.
Right.
And then, obviously, conspiracies that will develop over this debate on gun control.
Mm-hmm.
And then, again, this issue on violence in movies and the effect of violent images on films.
Right.
Do you want to start with gun control? Or?
Well, let's see. Being from Canada, of course, I grew up around guns. We had 22s and 30-odd sixes in the house, and no time did we go crazy. So do guns make people crazy? So I'm of two camps of this, because there's also something about the culture. In this idea of the how the West was won with a gun, and justice coming from a gun, and you solve your problems with a gun. This image is shown over and over again since the silent film era. I mean, the that whole thing would make me think that as a society, I would want stricter gun control laws in this country than other countries that haven't grown up on those images. Therefore, I am in the minority because I'm the only one that sees a connection between Westerns being shown for generations and gun control.
I, again, always like getting back to the text that gets largely annoyed when we talk about the fear of they're going to take our guns away from us, right? They're working to take our guns away from us. The Second Amendment of the United States reads,
right,
a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. A well-regulated militia.
Right, well-regulated.
Being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. The purpose of this amendment is pretty clear when you read all of it, which is under a well-regulated militia, the people who are the members of that militia,
right,
should have the right to have arms because the founding fathers did not want a standing army.
Right. Yeah.
It was an army of the people.
Because you didn't want a standing army because it could be a coup or some sort of...
Well, where was the money going to come from, too?
Yeah, that's true.
They couldn't pay, you know. I mean, they had to borrow money from Europe to pay for the, you know, from France and Netherlands to be able to pay for the... But it's really interesting, this well-regulated militia idea. And it's fascinating because we've actually had several Supreme Court justices in the last few years go on record as saying that first clause is meaningless.
Really?
Yeah.
That's not
so it's
connected.
Just about the right to the people to bear arms. Wow. And so again, context is very important.
Yes.
This fear over President Obama is out to steal your guns, to take your guns, to take away your Second Amendment rights. I don't understand where this is coming from.
I don't either, because he's made gun control more lax in his administration than...
The Brady Foundation, named for James Brady, who was shot in the... A Republican who was shot and sustained brain damage in the assassination attempt on Ronald Reagan. They do a report card that keeps track of every public servant and their track record on gun control.
Right.
Obviously, the Brady Foundation... The proponents behind the Brady Bill are in favor of gun control.
Right.
So that's the prism through which they view this issue. Obama consistently gets an F- grade in every one of the categories they grade. He is, therefore, according to the Brady Foundation, which is all about being in favor of gun control, according to them, President Obama is the best friend Americans and their guns have ever had.
I think that's true.
So this becomes then interesting where, you know, how does the conspiracy theory become the conspiracy?
Right.
You know,
where do you get the story that he's trying to take away your guns?
Yeah.
When you see all the laws that have been passed recently.
I have always had an interesting, I don't like guns. I have no interest in them. They're not fascinating to me. But again, if it's a right for people to have them, then okay, it's a right for people to have them. I would like to see responsible checks and all of all these sort of things.
Right.
Should try everything we can to keep them out of the hands of criminals. If you have committed a criminal act, you forfeit some of your rights.
Right.
Now, in an issue like this, however, this person had no criminal record, and you can't say, well, we ought to be able to keep them out of the hands of crazy people because, as we know, mental illness descends quickly.
Yes.
And it's descending quicker and quicker in our contemporary age. So it's not about keeping them, therefore, out of the hands of people who are crazy. It's about keeping them out of the hands of people who might one day suffer from mental illness.
Right. So how do you do that?
How do you do that?
Right. Then your Minority Report precog.
But it is interesting how this is such a divisive issue that becomes so inflamed that it keeps people away from communicating with each other. I mean, I always think that one of the failures of the environmental movement to me is in enlisting the aid of the NRA. Because throughout the history of this country, our greatest conservationists have always been Hunters.
Hunters, yeah, yeah. That they want to keep that.
They tend to be the people who care about nature in a way the most.
Yeah, exactly.
And
because they're
out
there.
Can you not enlist them as allies in your movement? However, PETA is an organization that is very influential and important in the environmental movement, and they are never going to go to bed with the NRA
right.
on an issue.
Because theirs is strictly about animal cruelty.
Yeah.
So
and so they would define hunting
right.
as not ethical treatment of animals.
Which may or may not be true, because there's also the argument in Canada quite often that the culling of the herd allows for the population not to crash because of depleting food sources. All animal species go through cycles where there's plenty of food, suddenly they breed and there's many of the animals, and then that food source becomes scarce, and then they all crash in the population and they're dwindled down to a small minority, and then the food's allowed to grow again, the food source. So it goes through these cycles. So the idea of by allowing well-regulated hunting with licenses and that sort of thing allows that population never to crash to the point of extinction.
Yeah.
So, therefore, you know, that's the environmental argument for hunting.
We could talk about this for a long time. I want to move on to this issue of violence in the media.
Right.
You know that I was very uncomfortable with The Dark Knight. And I was uncomfortable with the reaction, the embrace of it, and the emotional tenor of the embrace that the public had to this movie that was all about chaos.
Right.
And it really unnerved me. Upon repeat viewings, I learned to appreciate some things about the movie much more than I had the first time. I also began to see some flaws in that movie in ways that I hadn't
right.
the first time. It's two movies. It's
exactly.
A split antagonist. I thought that, many of the reviews were, again, you can't remove it from context, but many of the reviews were colored by the feeling of loss people had over the death of Heath Ledger.
Right.
And so there was much more affection for that movie than maybe the movie itself in a vacuum, if such a thing could exist, warranted.
Right.
Suddenly now we're in a place where now The Dark Knight Rises is going to be again viewed. It can no longer be viewed out of context. It's going to be viewed in context.
Yeah.
I was made very uncomfortable by that film, and that's okay. You know, film and art and culture is part of the conversation.
Right.
And
all movies are in context.
And so do we have an awesome responsibility as storytellers to show that violence has consequences? Do we have an awesome responsibility to show that we have failed when we let anyone slip through the cracks of modern society into mental illness? Do we have these responsibilities? I believe so. Does that mean that you are not entitled to make any movie that you want? Of course not. You're entitled to make any movie you want.
And we express have to. Yourself creatively.
We have to, because the thing about responsibility is it doesn't exist in a world where only certain kinds of expression are allowed.
Right, which goes back to stand-up comedy and Tosh.
Responsibility requires freedom.
Right.
And that's why with freedom, hopefully, comes the acknowledgement that we have a responsibility. We have many responsibilities.
Yeah.
It's not freedom from responsibility, and that's the thing that gets so frustrating for people, is that with freedom comes great responsibility, and with the sense of that responsibility seems to come a limitation to freedom.
Yeah.
A lot of times.
But in that, it goes back to Da Vinci then, that no creativity can exist without some restrictions, without some walls to either come up against or some craft to go beyond with. Does that make sense?
Yes. And I think the problem that I have with every conversation when it comes to be about violence in movies or gun control or even the pharmaceutical drugs or whatever it is.
Yeah.
When the conversation is about seeking blame.
Right.
the conversation needs to be about what kind of culture do we want to live in? How can we create the healthiest culture possible? What responsibilities do we have within our industry to self-correct?
To self-correct.
As you said, that was right. A really great point. What responsibility do we have with each other to say, you know what, we do have a responsibility here. No, we're not to blame. We're not to blame for this.
Right.
We do have a responsibility, all of us, in this culture, to do the best we can within our particular bailiwicks to build the healthiest culture we possibly can.
Right.
And to appeal to other people to do the same thing.
And that appeal should come by the very fact of we are rewarded or punished, be it financially or with an audience attending whatever we create, that becomes in itself its own merits. Do you know what I mean? As opposed to thinking of it outside, that should happen within the triangle of performer, audience, medium.
Well, I suppose if you also include then the sense of punishment that 60 people were shot in a place that we all love, which is a movie theater, if we take that personally, we really have to take that personally. I've spoken a great deal about don't take criticism personally. This is something that is this transpersonal event, right?
Right.
You and I don't know anyone who was there.
Right.
We don't know the relatives of these people. We don't know them. But we have to, as human beings, take that personally. And we have to take it personally to the sense that it returns us again to our sense of personal responsibility.
Right.
That we have failed when we let... You know, you know, I'm a dick, and
I
will admit to being a cynical bastard and being caustic and all these things, and in no small part because sometimes I'm defending myself from how deep I love people. And it saddens me whenever we lose anyone through the cracks,
right,
into mental illness. It really does sadden me that someone can get to the point that they think that they are so worthless that opening fire
on
other human beings and ending these lives, permanently altering and damaging so many others, that is a choice that someone can get to.
Right.
I feel, to a degree, James Holmes.
Yeah.
If indeed he's the one that did this, he's guilty. He's the one person that's guilty.
Right.
And I feel very personally the sense that we failed him.
Right. As a society.
As a society. When they called his mother... And
down in San Diego, yeah.
And his mother, who's a nurse, her response was, yeah, you got the right guy. Boy, that's powerful.
Wow.
You know, it brings to mind where was the mother?
Family.
Where was the family? You know, I talked about this film. You know, I talked about how disturbed I was by the reaction to Dark Knight.
Yeah.
Last year when we were doing our top 10 show, I talked about everybody, we need to talk about Kevin.
Yeah, yeah.
The movie starring Tilda Swinton.
Yeah.
In a Columbine-like storyline. And the reaction to that movie of people in our industry, I went to a Directors Guild screening of it.
Yeah.
And people walked out because it was just too dark or it was too unpleasant, too whatever.
Right.
Too harrowing. And I was really disturbed because I said to you, if we who share this enormous responsibility of the media can't look at these issues.
Yeah.
Aren't we really in danger of failing in our public responsibility?
Right.
Of helping to advocate a healthier culture. And you know, we do. We fail a lot.
Right. Because it's hard to do.
It's hard to do. It's hard to do, and you do feel powerless a lot in your own unique way. So incidents like this happen at Aurora, Colorado, and they will happen again and again, and we will each time We will wring our hands and we will talk about how things need to change. We'll talk about how things need to change and nothing will change. And it will happen again and again and again. And I truly believe that a culture beyond violence is possible and that that's only the beginning. Right. That there is always work to be done in advocating a healthier culture.
Right.
And, you know, as much as we can to be someone who does reach out to other people and say, hey, is everything okay? Or, hey, you're awesome.
Right.
Even when it might be the hardest to do that, even when what they're venting at us is something that it's almost impossible not to take personally.
Yeah, exactly.
So so there is the responsibility to it, but there isn't blame.
That's right. And we are responsible for Chilpack Hollywood.
And we didn't get to so many of the things that I know you like about the movies that we've seen.
I
saw
a
wonderful movie that I'll want to talk about. We didn't talk about what we're reading.
I know.
If we had talked about a lawsuit of the week, speaking of Where Was the Mother, it would have involved the disappearance of Michael Jackson's mother, Catherine.
I know. What the heck? Yeah.
Isn't this interesting?
That's really bizarre.
And really, in a lawsuit that's about family members suing family members and the mother disappears. Well, that was always the question in the Jackson family, wasn't it? With Michael's story. Where was the mother in all of this?
That's really true.
So we'll get to that next week. Next week.
Okay.
And we've told people how they can find us.
Yes.
Until then, I'm Phil Lynch.
I'm Dean Haglund.
Belated spoiler alert.